I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe, Josh Rappaport. He's co-publisher of Singing Turtle Press and co-president of Now I Get It Tutoring. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's been absolutely years since you were last on the show, and I think we were talking about algebra at the time.
Well, it's true.
You've got a wonderful book called Algebra Survival Guide, which is now in its second edition. And you do a lot of tutoring with young people who are preparing for things like the SAT and the ACT. First of all, there's two different standardized tests. What are they? What's the difference?
Yeah, that's true. This is one of the things that a lot of parents don't know about, because the ACT, which is the newer of the two tests, has only come into prominence in the last 15 or so years. So people my age and parents generally know the SAT. That's what we were raised on.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's this other test called the ACT, and it's actually become more popular than the SAT.
You mean colleges use it more?
Colleges. It's not so much that colleges use it more, but students tend to generally prefer the ACT over the SAT. It's become the test of choice among high school students these days. That's for a number of reasons, but the main point is that there are two tests, and your child, if you're a parent, needs to take only one of the two. Some people think they should take both, and that's double the studying, double the stress. There's no need to do that.
When you say it's the preferred test for kids, I mean, do colleges really care what the kids prefer? I mean, don't they have their standards?
Generally speaking, colleges, if they require that students take the standardized test, they'll say you can take either the SAT or the ACT.
Okay.
It used to be the case that colleges would prefer one or the other. Nowadays, I don't know of any colleges that say we only take this one or that one.
Now, back in my day, I hate saying that because it makes me feel so ancient, but
you can say our day if you
back
feel
in
any better.
Our day, around, like, let's say the 70s and 80s.
Right.
We didn't study for the SATs. We just took them. And yeah. Our preparation in school was considered the preparation for these tests. Now studying for them seems to be the norm, which I wonder whether that even invalidates the test's value.
That's a really good question. I would say that a lot of students do study for it. I was one just like you. I didn't study at all. Just went in, took the test. Didn't even get very good scores, honestly. And that was it. Took it once and it was over. Nowadays, in Santa Fe, I would say maybe 30% of kids study for it. Not everyone does, by a long shot. As far as whether or not it invalidates the scores, I wouldn't actually say it invalidates them, but what it does do is it gives those who study a huge advantage over the students who don't study for them.
Right, and there's an economic piece of that, which is the kids who can afford to have, you know, to the parents who can afford to send their kids to studying. But that said, what is on these tests, and how useful are they for evaluating what a student knows?
That's a good question, too. The tests are a little different as far as what's on them. Overall, I think both tests are actually fairly good, as tests go, at what their purpose is. Their stated purpose is figuring out, helping colleges see how ready students are for college. So what both tests do, I think, pretty well, is they have students do a lot of reading for comprehension in a short period of time and see how well the students can answer the questions. That's an important skill you have to do in college, awful lot of reading. They test for your overall fluency with math, knowledge of math, but also your ability to kind of constructively put math concepts together and come up with an answer to a situation you've never seen before. That's important, but maybe not as important as just doing well at math in school might be. So the tests vary in terms of how well they prepare students for college or help colleges figure out how well they're prepared. But overall, I think they do a fairly good job. In my view, they're better than a lot of tests that students have to take, and they're more worthwhile because they actually teach students some things that will be skills they use in college.
So what kinds of things are on the tests that are new. I mean, I think there's a writing piece.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so as far as what's new, the essay, we didn't have to do the essay back in the day. There's a required essay on the SAT, and the essay's optional on the ACT. The essay's a little bit crazy because you get a prompt, something to write off of. You have to take in the prompt, analyze it, outline your essay, write the essay, proofread the essay in 25 minutes on the SAT. They give you a big bonus of 5 extra minutes for 30 minutes on the ACT. That in itself is enough to drive a lot of people nuts. So what we do in our courses is we teach students how to manage that situation, how to structure your time. That's one of the new things that's really challenging. Another thing that's new for most students is the science section of the ACT. The science section has the biggest psych-out factor of all the sections.
What do you mean?
What I mean is students will see something on, say, radioactive decay of, you know, alpha particles and gamma particles, and they'll see charts and graphs detailing it, and they have to answer questions about this stuff in a very short period of time. And a lot of students just get psyched out, and they say, I never studied that. I have no idea how to do that. And what we teach students is, it doesn't matter whether or not you ever studied it. What matters is, can you answer the question? And the question is usually not that difficult when you get down to it, and mostly it involves reading graphs and charts and drawing some conclusions. A lot of it's actually common sense. But if kids don't study, they'll get psyched out. That's why it's so important. That's one of the main reasons it's important to do that studying.
So there's a real confidence building through familiarity with this particular medium.
Absolutely. You know, and when you mentioned a second ago that, you know, there is an economic piece, that can be mitigated to a large extent because there are lots of books available nowadays on how to study for these tests. If kids are motivated to do it on their own, and some are, not many, but some are, they can do it on their own. There are also online programs, and then there are courses that range in price. You know, there are very expensive courses, and there are courses that aren't very expensive. And students can find out about these opportunities through their guidance counselors. So there are ways to, you know, make the experience one that students whose families don't have a lot of money, they can still do well at these tests if they put their mind to it and make it a priority.
With the essay section, mm-hmm. It seems like the danger of subjectivity on the part of everything else can be scored by computer, but the essay portion has to be scored and read by a human being. How many tests has that human being read that day?
Oh, probably
2,000. How tired are they? What are that person's personal preferences? What about the next guy over? You know, it's...
Right. You can never get rid of the subjective factor with the essay. That's true. They try to get rid of it. Both tests try. They usually have two people scoring the test. If there's a discrepancy of 2 or more points between what the scorers say, they call in the quote-unquote expert reader who resolves the difference. So, to some extent, that's a problem. But, honestly, the bigger problem I see on the test, the essay test, is that students freak out. They don't know they don't have the experience of writing an essay in that short of time, and they freak out and they end up writing gobbledygook, and that can really hurt their score.
We're talking to Josh Rappaport of Now I Get It Tutoring. Another thing that is really important and kind of interesting is, you know, back in our day, we learned in public school, we learned grammar. We learned what an indirect object was and all that kind of stuff. To what extent is grammar tested, and to what extent are young people learning it these days?
The answers are pretty black and white to those questions. Grammar is tested a lot on both tests. There's a writing section of the SAT, and there's a comparable English section of the ACT. And the questions on those sections are 90% about grammar, punctuation, style, mechanics, what it takes to write well.
Yeah.
So that's definitely, those are both tested. And the answer to the second question, I can only speak to Santa Fe because these are the students I tutor the most, although we do tutor a little bit internationally up in Canada by Skype. But overall, what I've seen is students learn virtually no grammar any longer. And I think it's really sad. I know that you and I have both talked about being grammar nerds and being
proud
of it.
Well, my nickname is Conan the Grammarian.
Love it. And I've definitely offended a few people in my time by telling them it's whom, not who. But, you know, grammar is important not just for scoring points in some kind of intellectual battleground. Grammar is really fundamental to learning how to be a good writer. Yes, you can have someone who's a pretty good writer without grammar, but it's kind of like being a good chef without sharp knives. You can't master the fine points. So it's tested. Kids know virtually nothing any longer. And it's a shame because I think it's really important. So we actually start at square one. We teach students, what's a verb? What's a noun? What's a subject? What's a predicate? What should a sentence contain? And they have to take that in and learn it pretty quickly. They're ready to learn it. They have all the cognitive ability it takes, but they have so little background that they have to do a lot of catching up.
And it's so important because it basically excludes you from so many professions if you can't write standard written English. I mean, if you're a 15-year-old, you haven't learned any of this, then a couple of years later, you go to college, you can't write a paper, you're never going to be a lawyer.
That's
you're
right.
never going to be a scientist. You're never going to be an academic. You're never going to be a lot of, not that academia pays much, but you're never going to get into any of the sort of better paying professions if you cannot write a proper paragraph.
It's kind of psychotic in the sense that we are expecting more and more of students these days in terms of writing. With the Common Core standards now, students have to write a lot about math, interestingly enough. They have to explain their answers, and yet we don't give them, in certain cases, the tools for doing that writing. So that's a real problem I see, and I don't know why teachers don't teach grammar, why it's gotten taken out of the curriculum. I'd be interested in knowing, but it is a harsh reality. There's one other thing I'd like to just mention about the two tests, since we were talking about them, which is that there is a way to find out which test is better. And there is a diagnostic.
For a particular student?
For any student. There is a diagnostic procedure students can go through. They take a battery of short little tests, and I can analyze those and figure out, are they more suited for the SAT or the ACT? Which test are they likely to score better on? And I've been doing these with students around Santa Fe, and the great thing is, I've cut their study time in half, practically, by doing that, because now they know I'm just going to focus on the ACT, I'm not going to think about the SAT.
Whatever. Is there a type of, like, is it different learning styles? How would you characterize the difference?
To a certain extent, there's a different learning style. This is very general, but I would say that the SAT is a better test for people who like to just think on their feet, people who are really spontaneous, sharp in the moment. The ACT is a little bit more for people who are the classic good student. They'll grind away at their homework. They'll put in all that time and energy, and they just crank out the good grades year after year. The test, the diagnostic, makes that distinction a little bit. I also do a follow-up interview where I ask students questions about their personality and stuff, and it's kind of fun, actually. I'll ask them questions like, if you're going to go on a vacation and your family lets you plan one day, would you let it happen spontaneously or would you plan the whole thing out? And they don't know why I'm asking, but it does have to do with these temperament differences as far as which test is better for you.
There was somebody who was characterizing children and schools and thinking about how people are in the terms of hunter-gatherers versus farmers. And the hunter-gatherers are always aware of what's going around them 360 degrees, and they're aware of the weather, and they can turn on a dime. And the farmers get up at the same time every day and plant the seeds and cultivate the seeds, and it's a much more kind of slow process like the kids. And how the school systems tend to favor the latter. And there's so many metaphors like, you know, sowing, like, the sowing in the harvest and the next crop of kids and
That's
lining
true.
Them up in little rows. And if you were that, you know, turn on a dime kind of highly active kid who's always looking out the window, you're punished by the system, but it's just a different type of person.
Right. It is a different type of person. The SAT kid is definitely more the hunter-gatherer, looking for that next prey that's popping along.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is that at least with these tests, there is one kind of test for each kind of student. So we've got those two options nowadays.
Very interesting. So there are advanced subject tests. What does that mean? What is that?
Right. So, okay. These are subject tests put out by the College Board, which creates the SAT. And these give students a chance beyond the SAT or the ACT to shine in an area of academics in which they've got excellent skills and knowledge. So, for example, there are subject tests for math. There's a physics subject test, a chemistry subject test, and there's a history subject test, a literature subject test. There are subject tests for foreign languages, you know, French, Italian, German. Colleges that are more selective basically nowadays expect students to take at least two of these subject tests. This is something a lot of people aren't even aware of. So that's an important piece too. And in the classes we're doing, we're starting to do coaching classes for the subject tests as well as the standard SAT and ACT.
Education in America has gone through so many different phases. I mean, we went through phases of deep segregation by both race and gender, and then that came together, and when we were in college, there were a lot of scholarships for people, and I remember being in a, you know, so-called elite school with a lot of non-elite people and some elite people too. And now the price of education has gotten so crazy that the whole system is now skewed that you basically have to be fabulously wealthy, or your parents have to be fabulously wealthy, to go to a four-year liberal arts college in most cases. Or you have to go into unbelievable debt that basically sets the course of the rest of your life. So what do you see kids talking about, thinking about? What are their hopes and expectations? What are their realities?
That's an interesting topic. You know, some students are fortunate in ways other than just coming from families that have a lot of money. Some students are especially good at academics. And one of the things some people don't realize is there's a test before the SAT or the ACT called the PSAT.
Right.
Many people know about it. It's like the pre-SAT. If students do well, very well on that test, and they can qualify to become what's called a National Merit Scholar or a National Merit Finalist or semi-finalist, that can open up tremendous opportunities for scholarships at big schools around the country. Not so much the little elite liberal arts schools, but universities will sometimes give students absolutely free rides on tuition and even room and board sometimes if they score very high on those tests. That's one way to kind of equal the playing field for students who don't come from families with a lot of money. There are books that have been written on how to get scholarships. One guy who wrote a book pretty much got his way paid going to Harvard because he was so aggressive in getting scholarships. And he got not just one, he got many scholarships.
Oh my goodness.
Year after year. And he shows you how to do that. So it's kind of like if there's a will, there's a way. Anybody can go to college if they have the will. There's a way to do it. I'm not a college counselor, but we put students in touch with college counselors, and really good college counselors can point the way toward those ways to get through the system.
One of the things that we talk about is, okay, kids aren't learning grammar anymore, and this teaching is not so good, that teaching is completely gone, there's no music, there's no art, there's limited PE, at least in New Mexico, I don't know about the rest of the country.
Right.
Is there any ways in which kids are stronger than they were a generation ago?
They're stronger test takers because they're asked to take so many tests these days. And I'd say that as a society, we've probably reached that proverbial tipping point where now we're kind of stepping back and saying, do we want to be giving students this many tests? You know, the state that really got everything started actually was Texas when George Bush was governor down there. And he had a advisor named Sandy Kress, and Kress was really committed to the idea of doing lots of standardized testing. And he got the ball rolling to where nowadays some high school students take as many as 15 standardized tests per year. And these are tests that they don't just take, they study for them. Their teachers are prepping them, are coaching them for those tests. And this is one of the reasons that the amount of time that's spent prepping for those tests is one of the reasons that PE vanishes, art vanishes, music vanishes. Even in math, let's say, which is one of the areas people focus on, interesting aspects of math get tossed aside because they're not on the test.
So what happens to their curiosity, to their creativity, to their ability to contemplate and come up with answers and think of things, which is ultimately, all of those things are ultimately the basis of human intelligence?
Well, the creativity piece gets terribly eroded, in my opinion, by the intensity of the focus on standardized testing. Now, I'm not against testing per se. When I was a teacher, I gave tests, and I thought the test results were interesting, and they told me a lot about how the students were doing, gave me good feedback. But it's the sheer number of tests. So let me give you an example. Let's say that there's a geometry teacher, and in the first weeks of class, the geometry teacher is going through the foundations of geometry, the logical foundations of geometry. And let's say that the teacher, someone who's studied what's called non-Euclidean geometry, which is a fascinating area of geometry, which is based on the idea that if you have a line and a point not on the line, it's possible to have infinitely many parallels to the first line through that point. I mean, at first it seems impossible.
Right.
How could that be? But entire systems of geometry have been based on that fascinating idea. And as people say, whole worlds that were unknown have been discovered. And they've been actually found to relate to Einstein's vision of space-time. So the math actually preceded our discoveries in science. You know, you talk to a teacher who knows this, and you might say, so did you talk about non-Euclidean geometry? You were right there doing the foundations last week. And he'll say, well, it isn't in the schedule of what I could do, and I have to do this much because of the schedule. And then if you ask another question, well, what's the schedule based on? Oh, that's based on the Common Core. Well, what's the Common Core tied to? The Common Core is tied to the PARC testing. So in other words, it all gets back to the test. If there's a test, it can squelch the exciting, creative stuff that teachers would otherwise teach. I think it's a terrible, terrible loss. Students don't even know what they're missing. It's gotten that bad in some cases.
Now here you are, Josh Rappaport, with an evident, obvious, gigantic love of teaching and of math, and this book of yours, The Algebra Survival Guide, is beautifully illustrated by Sally Blakemore, who's a local artist and a total genius, and you make it fun, you make it accessible, you care about students as human beings, and yet you find yourself in this position where you're tutoring for exactly these standardized tests.
That's true. And I guess I view it kind of like, I want to almost say like being a defense attorney who's representing someone who doesn't feel that great about it. I'm kind of representing the test as something the student has to deal with, like it or not. And my job is to help the student deal with the test as well as possible. You know, I can't both tutor and fight the big battle about standardized tests, and lots of people are fighting battles over that now. So my job is to make the experience for students as humane, as manageable as I can.
Now, in that process, do you sometimes find them discovering that curiosity and that joy that does come up in both math and English, if you've got a good teacher, if you're open to it in that way?
Yeah, I do. I mean, anything that's taught with enthusiasm can be interesting. Even a standardized test. You know, a standardized test is going to deal with topics that are interesting. And whether I like the fact that students are being bombarded by these tests or not, the math itself that underlies it can be exciting and can be interesting, and I try to bring that out. Same thing with the grammar. I love teaching the grammar. And I find it fascinating. I find it fascinating why we use, you know, who versus whom. And I try to bring that out and show students the logic behind grammar. So
and why
it can
you
be interesting.
And why you can't say between you and I.
Exactly. Why you can't say between you and
I. Ladies and gentlemen, it's between you and me. Don't ever say it again wrong. There will be a quiz at the end of this broadcast. So you are doing some workshops for parents. You're doing some presentations. All of the information on this is available at singingturtle.com. What does it mean to do a presentation or a workshop for parents?
Well, for parents, what I like to do is help parents help their students with elementary school math. That's my big focus right now with parents, because the new standards that the PARC tests were based on, these Common Core standards, involve a certain way of looking at math that most parents didn't grow up with. So I'm doing a workshop May 2nd at Lafarge, 4 to 5:30, and it's free. It's open to the public. I'd love to see a lot of people there. And we're going to talk about how can parents understand this Common Core math way of looking at math, and how can they then help their students with it. A lot of what it comes down to, actually, with Common Core is being more flexible with numbers. We were taught in sort of a rote way. And actually, this goes back to what you asked earlier. Are kids better at some things today than before? I'd say that because of these Common Core standards, students are starting to become more fluent with how numbers work. I'll give you a quick example. Let's say student has to do the problem 7 plus 5, okay, they're in first or second grade. When I was in school, when we were in school, we probably just had to memorize the fact. It was on that sheet of memorizable facts. Nowadays, someone would look at 7 plus 5 and say, think of lots of ways you could do this. One way would be to say, okay, we're in a base 10 system. We want numbers to get to 10 if we can, because that gives us a nice touchstone. So how many does 7 need to get up to 10? It needs 3. Well, steal 3 from 5, or maybe more politely, ask 5 politely to give 3 of its 5 away to the 7. When it does that, it only has 2 left. The 7's gone to 10, the 5's gone down to 2, so we've recast the problem as 10 plus 2. And now you can see from that that it's 12.
Right.
And that's just one way of decomposing and recomposing a problem that the Common Core likes to do. And it's actually fun when you get used to it. And it makes math more interesting, I believe. And it makes students better math thinkers.
And some of those things maybe work better for visual learners, because if you think of 7 as something that can be added to, there's a kind of visual piece of that.
You know, you can take almost any concept or skill in math and you can present it in different ways. So for you, it sort of comes across as visual. I would suspect that means you're a pretty visual person. But for somebody else, they might take what I said about 7 borrowing 3 from the 5 and think of it in the verbal story terms. That's a story to them.
Right.
So it depends on your learning style as far as how you're going to interpret it. A good teacher will be aware that students have multiple learning styles. You know, in a classroom, we're going to have all kinds of learning styles, and we'll try to present the same information in a variety of ways.
And that's something that also is fairly new. I don't think the phrase learning style existed 30 years ago.
I don't remember it ever being used. And that's actually one of the things that I would say has turned a lot of students off to math. You know, we talk a lot about math anxiety and how people got tormented by math. One of the reasons is that people who went into math teaching were often very much math people. They wouldn't necessarily think in stories. They wouldn't necessarily think in pictures. And if students couldn't relate to that way of presentation, they would feel lost. Where now I think there's more awareness of different styles. I think it's been a net positive for teaching.
One of the things in your book, The Algebra Survival Guide, is you cover things that many of us, including me, did have some math anxiety about, even if we were good at math in general, and that is word problems. An example of a word problem is you've got a tank with 3 pipes coming into it each at different rates of flow that start and stop, and two pipes going out of it at also different diameters and rates of flow that also start and stop, how long will it take for the tank to fill?
Exactly.
And you look at that and you're under pressure and you just want to break your pencil and go home.
Yeah, or smash the tank.
Or say, who cares, just wait for it to fill.
Right, right. You know, there are a lot of reasons that students struggle with word problems. And one of them is simply that some students get kind of engrossed in the fact that it's a story and they want to follow the story. You know, if it's about Mo and Joe being 200 miles apart, they might say, well, why are Mo and Joe 200 miles apart? And why do they even want to drive toward each other? That sort of thing. But another problem, and I think probably the biggest problem with word problems, is students don't know where to start. They look at a word problem, and it's not like a multiplication problem where they know, first you do this, then you do this. They're like, what do I do? Where do I start? So what I try to do in my book, in this expanded new chapter, is give them a two-stage process for solving word problems. And basically, it involves what's called a master formula and a master equation. If I can indulge the listeners and present an analogy, I think that would help people understand this. So my analogy for solving word problems is an algebraic word problem is a lot like having someone give you a jigsaw puzzle with one piece missing and saying, find this one piece, find the shape of that one piece. So if we just think about the jigsaw puzzle solving process for a minute, it will shed some light on the algebra process. What most people do when they solve jigsaw puzzles, from what I've seen, is they'll first make the outline, the frame of the jigsaw puzzle. Those are easy to find because they're square-edged pieces. And then after they've made that frame, they'll start putting pieces together on the side, and then they'll start plugging those little chunks of pieces into the frame as they find them fitting, and then they'll work toward the middle. And lo and behold, they finally have filled in everything except that one piece. So they could just say, there's that, the shape of the one piece. How does this relate to word problems? Well, with word problems, there's what the first stage is finding the master equation. In the same way that frame of the jigsaw puzzle captures the picture of the jigsaw puzzle, the master equation captures the entire situation of the word problem. So in the one you gave about the pipes, it would be something like the water that goes into by pipe one plus the water that goes into pipe two equals the water that goes into the tank. That captures the big picture. The second phase of solving word problems involves what I call the master formula. That's like sticking the pieces together of the jigsaw puzzle and then plugging them into the frame. In the algebra, that's equivalent to getting your quantities. Like, how do you get the amount of water put in by the first tank? How do you get the amount of water put in by the second tank? And there's a formula for that. So it would be the rate of the pipe times the time that the pipe is operating equals the amount of water going in. So that in that stage, you get these little quantities, and you plug those into the equation, the overarching equation. And if you do that correctly, and you do a few steps of math called solving it, then you will find that one missing piece. And so it's really just a two-step process. Once kids know it, they can apply it to any other
right.
word problem.
And it's like when you look at it as a whole, it's crazy. When you break it down, it makes sense.
That's like so many things in life. Good lesson for life.
Josh Rappaport is co-publisher of Singing Turtle Press and co-president of Now I Get It Tutoring. And once again, much more information available at singingturtle.com. And also the book Algebra Survival Guide, second edition, can be found in all our local bookstores.
That's right.
Thank you so much for being with us in the Radio Cafe.
It was a delight. Thanks for having me.